Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of BOA Audio. This is definitely one of those episodes where I'm really happy that I have my own show because I'm going in a direction that is fueled by my own crazed interest in this story that's emerged over the last few months. I'm talking about the bizarre saga of Robert Durst, and I was raving about it on the Banal of America Facebook page, telling folks to check out the jinx, and after the jinx, I had to consume as much as I possibly could about this case and this story. It was so compelling. And luckily, and I wanted to do a show on the case for BOA Audio, and luckily, all of it sort of came together because our guest tonight, Matt Birkbeck, he wrote the book A Deadly Secret, which actually came out back around the turn of the century, around 2002, 2003, and has reissued the book in light of all the stuff that's gone on with Durst since 2002 and all the stuff that's happened in the past year. So for someone like me who just got into this, it was like, first, I got an incredible education on what really went down behind the scenes on this case. And then sort of a look at someone who's been looking at this thing for so long and their, you know, how they see this all unfold now in real time, which is crazy about the whole thing. So welcome to the show, Matt. Thank you so much for coming on the program. I absolutely love the book.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
And I got to tell you, dude, I actually kind of did something I'd never done for this show before. I read the book twice, read it a couple weekends ago, and then today sat down and read it again because I wanted to make sure I knew what I was talking about here with this story and this case, and I loved it so much. It's really amazing. And like I said, I recommended The Jinx to people, but really, they need to read this book first because that really really sets the stage for a lot of it. You know, having seen the special, too, it's like a complete disconnect. There's a lot of things that are very, very different about it. But before we get into all that, take me through, you know, the bio background on Matt Birkbeck. Introduce yourself to the audience and tell us how you got wrapped up in all this.
Well, I've been a journalist for a long time. I've written for a number of different magazines and newspapers across the country, including Reader's Digest, New York Times, Playboy. And at the time, back in 2000, when I was assigned to their story, I was working for People Magazine, and we were reacting to stories that had broken in two New York newspapers about this new investigation into the 1982 disappearance of a woman named Kathy Durst. Mm-hmm. And so I spent about 3 weeks on it. I wrote a lengthy story, and it was published early December of 2000, and then 3 weeks later, a woman by the name of Susan Berman was murdered. And that's the story that first gained its national focus.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. I guess we'll do what I'll tell you what we'll do, because I'm sure you kind of have to do this all the time. I'll do the thumbnail here on the Durst story so we can just catch people up on it. I'll do like a two-minute elevator thing here so that way you don't have to tell the story for the millionth time. And you can fill in any details and stop me if you feel like I missed something important. But the gist of it all is, for folks who aren't even familiar with all this, go and check it out. But here's the story in a nutshell. Robert Durst, he's a millionaire real estate scion. He's the heir to a huge real estate fortune in New York City, just massive, massive, massive. In the 70s, he falls in love, gets married to this lady, Kathy McCormick, who ends up becoming his wife, Kathy Durst. early 80s, I think 82 or 83, I think 83, Kathy Durst goes missing. And essentially, you know, before we start getting into all the nitty-gritty details, the case goes cold. Then about 18 years later, the case opens up again. The New York police want to look at it again. And that's when, as Matt said, all this stuff went down. The media gets wind of it. Durst gets wind of it. He runs down to Galveston, Texas to hide out. But in the meantime, his closest confidant during the Kathy Durst years, she gets murdered. 9 months later, murders his neighbor, gets caught for that, and dismembers the dude, and then runs off and jumps bail to run around the country for a few months. Gets caught, brought back to Galveston, goes on trial, pleads self-defense, gets off, which is amazing. Then serves a few years in prison, kind of hangs around the country for a while, then reemerges here this year with this Jinx show. Which is like the first time he's ever really spoken or given an interview or anything like that. And then throughout the course of the Jinx, other things are happening in the real world, and then sort of this transformative moment comes along where, like, the real world and the show collide, and the police now have arrested Robert Durst for what seems like evidence that was found during the making of the Jinx, but we're going to find out about that stuff tonight. But that's the general thumbnail story of Robert Durst. Did I get that pretty much right?
That was pretty good.
Thank
you. Nice job. I don't know if I could have done it any better.
Awesome. Awesome. So that's the whole thing. I guess I want to get into your mind here because you wrote the book a while ago, obviously, and then all this is happening. It's like Durst is such an elusive character. The whole thing is everyone's talking about this guy. You know, we never really even find out anything from this guy until all this show came along. I guess as someone who spent years studying this person, what did you think as you were watching him finally, like, speak for the first time? I know he was on trial and was, you know, on the stand in Texas, but this is a whole different kettle of fish.
Well, I saw him, like you just said. I did see him. I covered the trial in Galveston in 2003, and I saw him in court in Pennsylvania in early 2002 when he was extradited. So watching him during the first few episodes, the way he was talking, his mannerisms and whatnot, it wasn't much of a surprise. You know, if anything, it was unsurprising. I thought I'd see more. What really struck me was the ending of the Jinx.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, as you mentioned, and for those who saw it, they'll know what I'm talking about.
Right.
For those who didn't see it, it's, you know, when he basically, this is the first time you see, in my mind, the real Robert Durst, the Robert Durst I had originally covered back in 2001, 2002, 2003, the guy who people said, you know, was a serial killer. He knew how to dismember a body. You know, as I write in the book, the guy that was stealing identities for years, living in different cities across the country.
Right.
And then listening to him have these multiple conversations when he goes into this bathroom. I'm sure we'll get back into this later. And then admits to killing them all. That was the real Robert Durst. And, you know, after 5.5 episodes of what pretty much was kind of, I mean, it was interesting for people who had never seen Durst before or the Durst story. But the end of it was just, it was stunning.
Yeah, yeah. It was, like I said, it was like transformative TV. It was like nothing I've ever seen in my life on television. It was like, what is, this is crazy. You know, if he hadn't spent the 5 hours getting to know the guy, it wouldn't have that sort of punch in the gut thing. But I totally agree with you that having read the book, comparing it to the show, it's like there's a huge disconnect. There's the things that are really patently wrong that stood out to me. And I know you did a great interview with Vulture, so I almost don't even want to kind of get into too much of the questions sort of delved into there. Because one thing that stood out to me from the book was if Durst is villain A1 in the book, then this Gilberti is like villain 1B or something. You know, she, and the funny part is, having watched the special, I was like enamored with her. I loved her. I was like, oh, Gilberti, the best. Oh, she's in the last episode. Good. She deserves it. You know, after the show was over, they did a special Jeanine Pirro episode. Now that I realize I should have been more cynical about that. But I'm like, oh, I hope Gilberti will be on there, you know. And having read the book now, I'm like, those two, oh, give me a break. So I guess talk a little bit about her. She's probably listening, you know, because she seems obsessed with this whole thing. But talk a little bit about her, because this, I mean, I got to tell you, man, I really felt a lot of, like, suspicion surrounding her throughout this whole thing, having read the book. It's like she's the last person to see Kathy alive other than Bob. She never submits a deposition when they're interviewing people later on. This whole thing with her criminal background comes out in the book. There's a whole litany of stuff. You know, she breaks into Durst's house. It's like, there's a whole litany of things that she does that really, I don't know, make me very weary, I guess is the best way to put it. But talk a little bit about sort of what you've uncovered, you know, over the course of your years looking into this whole thing.
Well, when I was assigned the People piece, the first person I actually spoke to was Gilberta Najami. And during the first, actually during my reporting to the story, I mean, she was just a great source at the time in that she seemed to know the story inside and out. She was very dramatic, very compelling. She introduced me to other contacts. And when you're reporting on a story, you know, a magazine piece or even a newspaper piece, you have a very short period of time to report, unlike a book where you're going to be spending months.
Right.
So during this short period of time, to me and to a lot of other journalists who had dealt with Gilberta, she was golden. She was the source to go to. Okay. Well, over the course of the next year or so, cracks in her story began to develop. Now, I'm not just covering this for People magazine. I'm also writing the Reader's Digest, and I'm also now working on a book. And people that Gilberta, there were people she suggested I not interview or would say, this one doesn't know much about anything. One of those people was Ellen Strauss, who turned out to be not just a wonderful source, but she had evidence hidden away in a safe deposit box.
Right.
Which revealed what really happened with Kathy Durst that last day she was seen at Gilberta's house. And she also had this doctor's note, which got into Bobby Durst and his psychological problems when he was a youth. So I confronted Gilberta with some of this. She would dismiss it. She'd find a way to explain it away. And then, you know, other things would happen. And again, you know, my trust in her is fading quickly, particularly as a source. And then came the news that she was a convicted felon, that she had been arrested numerous times and mostly drug-related. You know, more importantly, though, she lied about, you know, Gilberta, for those who saw the Jinx and you saw it, she tells this very compelling story about, you know, how she was Kathy Durst's best friend, and she gets into the deterioration of the relationship between Kathy and Bobby Durst, and how Gilberta has this family party on this last Sunday that Kathy Durst has seen, and she invites Kathy over. It's a very quiet party, says Gilberta. Bobby's calling the house incessantly, demanding that Kathy return home. Kathy's scared, but she decides to go anyway and says to Gilberta, if anything happens to me, you know it was Bobby. That was Gilberta's story.
Right.
It wasn't the truth. It was far from the truth. And that really, I was really shocked that Andrew Jarecki, the director of the Jinx, would use her, and not only just use her, have her tell that same story without even challenging her on it, in that Jarecki and I, we've spoken going back since 2005. So Andrew knew the truth, you know, why he allowed her to do that, why he allowed Durst to say certain things that weren't true. You know, we can get into that in a little bit, but just sticking with Gilberta. So, you know, these source documents that this other woman, Ellen Strauss, had were written with Gilberta a week after Kathy disappeared. And Kathy and Gilberta's telling Ellen Strauss, you know, Kathy came to this party. It was a wild party. She drank 2 bottles of wine. She snorted 2 grams of cocaine. I interviewed another person who was at the party, and they said it was Kathy who left the house to pick a fight with Bobby.
Right.
And that Gilberta was prompting her to do it. So the story gets twisted on Gilberta's end, and you know, as far as law enforcement is concerned, she's not a credible source. As far as most journalists are concerned, she's not a for those who know her, she's not a credible source. You know, again, why Jarecki decided to include her and spend a lot of time with her, that's a question for him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's baffling, like I said, because like it changes the whole. It gives your book a whole different twist. It gives it a twist at the end because it was like a twist ending for me because I was like, "What? Wait a minute! This is crazy." So that's all thanks to the failings of the Jinx. Maybe I don't even want to speculate really, but I wonder why. You know, maybe just because that's the narrative that's been beaten like a drum over the years that Gilberta's tried to keep going all this time, that it just sort of stopped them.
Actually, yes, that was a narrative that a lot of other newspapers picked up. To this day, they continue to pick it up. They go read old clips, and they go, oh, great, let's rewrite the same thing.
Hmm.
But it's, you know, it's a narrative that, you know, I'm writing from an objective point of view. I'm trying to get to the bottom of what happened to Kathy Durst, for instance, and Susan Berman, and, you know, who was Morris Black, the guy that ended up dismembered, chopped up, and dumped into Galveston Bay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm trying to report accurately what the police did, what they didn't do, what prosecutors did, what they didn't do, what the families were doing, and above all, what Bobby Durst was doing, which, you know, I think I did a pretty good job with that, especially in the years leading up to these new investigations. But Gilberta really put a really unfavorable twist on this story and had people going in different directions that they never should have gone on.
Right.
And, you know, again, it's really unfortunate that Andrew Jarecki had decided to use her in his documentary.
Now, do you think you kind of like raise the idea, or maybe it was Ellen who raises the idea that like she, not to get too much into her head, but it's like she sort of drove the narrative because she felt so bad about pushing this, kind of lighting the fuse to the whole thing that may have ended Kathy's life. Because there's a part of me that almost wonders, because, I mean, we've come out of this whole thing kind of the conclusion that Durst is this, like, super evil dude. And, you know, I'm, like, 90% sure of that. But there's a part of me that's like, shit, how do I know that Gilberti didn't do all this? And she's, and Bob's just kind of on the side, like, I don't know anything about what you're talking, you know what I mean? It's like there's a part of me that really, really is suspicious of her role in all this.
That's interesting because my understanding is Bobby Durst, you know, aside from wanting to kill his brother Douglas, second on the list was Gilberta, in that he had read the book and, in fact, had two copies of the book in his condo when he was arrested. And my understanding is that he was not happy with Gilberta's retelling of this story. You know, to Bobby, Gilberta was someone who he did not want in their lives. I think when you read the book and you really and you start to see Gilberta and her story unfold, what you really see is a woman that's in love with another woman, and that other woman was Kathy Durst.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for her, it was about gaining her affections. There's a scene in the book in which Gilberta and Kathy actually go to the Caribbean, and they're sharing a room together, and Gilberta's got some delusions that somehow they're going to, you know, be intimate, but Kathy apparently goes off and meets someone who actually, I don't name the guy, so I can't name him now, turns out to be a very important New York politician. And Gilberta was very upset. She felt that she had been abandoned by Kathy. So, you know, Gilberta's story is
an unfortunate one.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate one. Like, you know, if you want to go down the cast of villains here, you got Bobby, and then you got Gilberta, and then you could throw Jeanine Pirro in there. I mean, there's a few of them that you can, you know, kind of throw darts at.
Yeah, a few of these could have their own documentary series. Well, another dude who I really came out of reading your book with a newfound respect for is the sergeant who really, oh man, where is it in the notes here? Where's his name on here? Jeez.
We're talking about Mike Strzok?
Yes, Mike Strzok. I'm sorry. I thought I had that written down. But yeah,
okay.
you know, it's funny because you talk about the ABC special, and it's like he fell victim to the same thing. It was deja vu all over again for him on the Jinx. It's like he really gets painted as this dude who didn't know what he was doing. But then when you read your book, it's like, no, he did know what he was doing. He's dealing with, you know, this lady who's making up stories, people who are making up stories to try and protect their job. It's like, no wonder the case went cold. He did the very best he could, it seems, from reading your book. But continually, like in these media pieces, he gets painted like they bungled the case, which is not the case.
I feel badly for Mike Strzok in that, you know, you're right on. He was painted very poorly in the Jinx. I have no idea why he agreed to interview. You know, I thought he was pretty much done with that, given how he had been treated by the media before that. You know, you're talking about a detective. You know, Bobby actually reports, shows up in the police station, meets with Strzok, tells him that his wife has been missing, and that's where the story begins, okay? Mm-hmm. And Strzok, you know, in the Jinx, basically, you know, Mike had spent some time on the case, you know, was looking in the wrong places at the wrong times, you know, spent most of his time in New York. And then basically the case went cold. And he had spent so much time on this case. I was lucky enough to get copies of the actual investigative files on Strzok's investigation. And he spent months digging into this. The problem for Mike was that he had two witnesses tell him that they saw Kathy Durst in Manhattan that Sunday night. Bobby had said that he put her on a train for New York, which was a lie, but Strzok didn't know that at the time. And there were two witnesses in the building where Kathy and Bobby had lived who said that, yes, we saw her here that Sunday night. So now he has no reason to believe that she was in Westchester. He's now thinking that she was definitely in Manhattan.
Right.
And so he spends a lot of time and a lot of effort, and actually at the end of the day, he wants to charge him with murder. Only the district attorney's office says no, because the case is circumstantial at best, and in the event, you know, given who you're going to be dealing with Durst and with his resources and the money and the family, they're going to hire the best attorneys, and let's just say he's going to be acquitted, and you can never file charges against him again because of double jeopardy. So, you know, for Strzok, it was unfortunate. And again, just like Alberta, where the media picks up on this old narrative that isn't true, they pick up on the Strzok narrative, which again is another thing in the Jinx that was really troubling, in that Jarecki knew the true story of Mike Strzok. So why he painted him in such a poor light, again, that's a question for Andrew Jarecki.
Now, have you, for the record or whatever, have you talked to him, like Jarecki, I mean, since this all came out, and been like, hey, dude, A, B, C, and D? I mean, obviously, you know, you're saying this to me. You've given interviews explaining all this. Like, has there been any word out of that camp or any sort of rumblings at all about any of this?
Yeah, we did speak. We spoke a few days after that last episode aired. And, you know, it was cordial. And, you know, I raised a couple of things with him, and he had, you know, he had his own answers for them. You know, I asked him not just about some of the things that people said. Look, he's a filmmaker. I'm a journalist. You know, I have a different threshold than he does.
Hmm.
And so he felt, for instance, that allowing Bobby Durst to, you know, tell the world that his father had put him in front of a window to watch his mother die, which wasn't true, but he felt allowing Bobby to say that was all he needed to do. You know, that was his only responsibility, was allow Bobby to say what he wanted unfiltered. And, you know, my response would be, well, you could have challenged him because, you know, wasn't true.
Yeah.
So, you know, this was his project. He asked me, we had met back in 2011 when he first told me that Durst had agreed to interview with him. And I was shocked when I heard that. But he asked me to interview, to sit down for some interviews with him, and I had declined. You know, given that we had two different views of Durst, you know, I firmly believed that he wasn't just a murderer, but in all likelihood was a serial killer. And Jarecki thought that Durst was a far more complicated guy who's, you know, was suffering through the weight of living with this influential and wealthy family.
Hmm.
You know, to me, it was a little too much for me.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I just, I just, you know, we agreed to disagree, and I declined to appear. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm glad I didn't appear. You know, that said, for all of its faults, and there were a lot of them, again, that last 10 minutes of the Jinx was, you know, perhaps some of the most stunning television I've ever seen.
Yeah, it was amazing stuff. Yeah, well, you wonder if it's like just the whole process of Durst thinking he's getting his way the whole time with Jarecki led him to being so let his guard down so easily at the end, but who knows?
That was, you know, that's interesting because the reason why Durst even approached him was because of Jarecki did the feature film All Good Things in 2010,
yeah,
which was based on the Durst story, and it was far more favorable to Durst. You know, it did paint him as this conflicted character who may have killed his wife, and that was about it. And so, you know, Durst reached out to Jarecki and agreed to do this documentary, believing he'd get similar treatment. Unfortunately for Durst, that didn't happen.
Hmm. Well, you touched on something here that seems, it's like sort of like one of the keystone debates, I guess, of people who look at this Durst thing. It's like there's some people who think that that he's a murderer, but he murders, you know, they're in the moment murders. They're necessary murders, let's say. I don't know. I can't come up with the right word off the top of my head here, but, you know, he kills Kathy, then he has to kill the other people sort of as he goes along to cover his tracks, essentially, you know. And then there's other people who seem to think that, as you scratch further below the surface, as you've said, that he may be just a serial killer, that he just kills for all sorts of different reasons, and that just because of the circumstances surrounding his wife and this lady, because they knew him, may be totally different or running parallel to this life as a serial killer, I think.
My take on it was, well, let me go back to when I got the People magazine assignment.
Yeah.
I thought it was this kind of a typical story where husband kills wife, gets away with it, and justice prevails 3 years later. And then Susan Berman is murdered a few weeks later, and then I'm still thinking in that vein, and now a witness is quieted. When Morris Fat Black was murdered, that's when this whole thing changed. And when I arrived in Galveston, the first thing at the police said to me, the detective, Cody Cazales, who was actually in the Jinx, first thing he said to me was that whoever dismembered Morris Black knew what he was doing. And that, to me, was just chilling. You know, you can't just open up a book and, you know, Dismemberment 101.
Yeah.
And, you know, and learn how to do that. It takes a lot of practice, especially when you know you have to go to the, without getting too graphic, you have to go to the right points.
Yeah, there's a whole technique involved.
Yeah, and so now he knows how to dismember bodies, and now I'm working on the book, and now I'm finding out that before this new investigation had begun, that Durst, throughout the late 1980s into the 1990s, Durst had been living this bizarre life. Imagine a guy with his kind of money and the resources he has being able to travel from city to city, stealing identities, dressing at times like a woman, living and hanging out near homeless shelters with transients. And, of course, he knows how to, or he learned somehow, to dismember a body. Now, what does that tell you?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, there's something going on here that's much, much bigger than a simple murder case. So it's something I wrote about. I get into deeply in the book in terms of describing what was going on. I had the help in terms of finding these identities. I had the help of a private investigator down in Texas named Bobby Basha, who was a great resource. And I've said this for years, thankfully now, and we actually have to thank, you know, the notoriety from the Jinx for this, and that the FBI now believes he's a serial killer. And they're looking in cities across the country where Durst had lived before, to see if they can tie him to any missing persons cases there in those cities.
It's pretty remarkable. And I did come out of the whole thing thinking the same thing, that he's a serial killer, because it makes there's no other reasoning for why he's doing all this, you know. And to go back, in a way, I feel, having read the book and seen the show, it's like I get annoyed because it's like these are questions that I want to ask Durst, You know, it's like, dude, what are you doing? Why are you traveling around the country doing this? You know, but he's never presented with this challenge, which makes it even more frustrating in a sense, because
It was frustrating watching it in that, you know, a real key part of the Dirk story is his psychology. I mean, you can clearly see there's something wrong with the guy when you're watching the Jinx, you know, by his movements. Now, he's claimed he's had Asperger's syndrome. You know, prior to the 2003 trial, I had never heard that before. And a lot of people think it's just something that the defense had dreamed up as part of their strategy. He clearly has got issues. You saw those issues manifest themselves in the last few minutes of the Jinx when he's having these bizarre, you know, different personalities and talking to each other. That's what it sounds like. Going back and forth, asking a question, he answers it. They ask her a question, what the hell did I do? He answers it, killed them all, of course. You know, it was really chilling, but clearly there's this whole psychological part of it, and it goes back, as I report in the book, which is another document Ellen Strauss had that Gilberto Najami didn't want the world to see for some reason, and that was this doctor's letter in which Durst, at the age of 10, was diagnosed with having severe psychological problems that, if left untreated, would create what the doctor said would be this severe psychodynamic force that would ultimately lead to other problems throughout his adult life, and we've seen those problems.
Yeah. Well, what do you make of the whole traveling around in drag part of it? Because to me, it makes me really wonder, like, if he's also dealing with, like, gender issues at the same time as all this is going on, or if it's just the best way for him to, his MO, you know, that it works perfectly for him to do what he wants to do. It's because, you know, I was interested from the book, you know, for folks like me who dive into all this stuff afterwards, that you say that the private investigator in Texas, Baca, she looked into the GQ article, which claims that Durst was, like, almost essentially transgendered down in Galveston, and that's not even that article is bogus. So
she couldn't find she went to the club where the story was based on, and she did speak to the one the person who was the leading cross-dresser there, and the person was actually insulted that someone else would, you know, usurp his
notoriety,
you know, number one status there, and said that they had no idea who this person was. So I don't, you know, the whole thing with Durst cross-dressing, when I first heard about it, obviously he did it to get the apartments, not just in Galveston, but also in New Orleans a few months later. So he had two different places to go to. You know, the fact that he was going to places dressed as a woman, and now I'm hearing that, you know, I reported on two other missing girls in California, one of which Durst apparently came to a store she worked at dressed in drag. I'm not sure what I can make of it other than I just keep thinking of the movie Psycho and Anthony Perkins and how he turns into his mother and dresses, you know, dresses as her.
Yeah.
And talks like her. And, you know, in this case, Durst was, dressing as a female, but as a deaf mute. But what's really intriguing about this, though, is that when he fled New York, when word of this new investigation broke in 2000, that's when I first heard about it and started writing about it, he didn't just dream up, you know, he didn't come up with this idea, oh, let me masquerade as a deaf mute woman and rent an apartment in some, you know, town that nobody's going to look for me in, meaning Galveston.
Right.
This is what he had been doing for years. He was prepared for it.
Exactly.
He knew how to do it. He knew where to go, and that's exactly what he did.
Ooh, makes it even more creepy. Now, just let me hit some sort of short ones here. It's kind of an interesting one, did it? Now, the early... A lot of people picked up on this because it was in the background of the Jinx, and it's actually in the book. This is like the theme of this episode is like, did you see the Jinx? Good. Read fucking A Deadly Secret because you're going to learn more. You're going to find out all the stuff you've been wondering from watching the show. The ransom note, this intrigued me. Strutt goes to Durst's apartment, and Durst shows him this ransom note. It's only like a paragraph in the book, and like I said, it's mentioned in the background, literally in the background of the Jinx. But do we know anything more about the ransom note? And since the show's come out, has anyone gone back and checked for block letters on that?
I don't know. I can't answer that question. My understanding was way back when the police believed it was something that Durst had concocted and really didn't put much thought into it. So,
did they say?
No, I don't recall. You know, I don't recall seeing it. There weren't too many things in the Jinx that surprised me. The only things I hadn't seen, of course, I didn't hear the ending, and I did not see the letter that he was confronted with.
Yeah.
With the handwriting on it. You know, most everything else I was pretty familiar with, so there weren't too many other surprises. I don't recall ever seeing this ransom letter, and my best recollection is that the police didn't think much of it.
Yeah. It would be interesting to see if they could ever, if it got, like, tossed out or if anyone...
It's a good question.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's something I think I might ask someone about.
Yeah, you should definitely see about that. The other thing I was wondering about is... you mentioned here that, and I had it in my notes, that Durst also has this apartment in New Orleans where he's pretty much pulling the same Dorothy Signer routine down in New Orleans. And when all the Morris Black stuff goes down, after he murders Morris Black and goes on the run, he ditches the apartment. But the dude who is renting the apartment goes back, and I love how Durst just leaves incriminating things behind all the time. He's insane. Amongst the stuff at the apartment is a medallion that says Davey Berman. This feels like this would be like something that the LA police would want to know about or something. This seems like a critical tell. That how does he have this unless he's somehow involved in the Berman murder?
Well, no, I'm sure they're aware of it and they know everything you need to know about it. But the genesis of that story is after Morris Black was murdered. I did another piece for People Magazine. Then I get a phone call from my editor in New York who says someone is desperately trying to reach me about the story. And I end up talking to the person, and he tells me that he has a brother who was on a flight from Mexico reading my story in People about this deaf mute killer or alleged killer from Galveston. And he says to himself, Jesus, I'm renting an apartment to the same type of person in New Orleans. It turns out, when the guy goes back to New Orleans, he enters into the apartment, and he had rented it out to a woman named Diane Winnie, who turned out to be Durst, and he had left behind, the Davey Berman medallion and some other personal effects of Susan Berman. I learned that story. I had actually called down to Cody Cazales in Galveston, and I related to him, and he rushed over the next day. He drove to New Orleans, and Durst was long gone, but he was able to not just get the personal effects of Susan Berman, but also a computer, and it was, if I remember, and some computer hardware,
yeah,
and a couple of other things. But clearly, Durst had been there.
Yeah. Well, it's just amazing that he, you know, I was just hilariously sort of put off that he, you know, like when he dumps Morris Black in the ocean and stuff, he just leaves receipts and all this other things with him. He's not very good at, well, I don't know why if he's a serial killer, I don't know how he slipped up so badly this time around, but.
Well, I think the general consensus is he believed that the body parts would have sunk into the bay, not floated like they did. And then come back to the shore. Mm. So it was a miscalculation on his part.
Yeah. And then by then, Dorothy Signer would have been long gone. So would have made a difference.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
Or maybe this is the bathroom.
Yeah, that's...
You're all right. This is the bathroom. There it is. You're caught.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
You're right, of course. But you can't imagine. What the hell did I do? Mm-hmm.